A taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening and welcome to A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn and my special guest this evening is Dominie Kemp. Dominie is an award-winning chef, food writer, author of 5 cookbooks. She runs restaurants, cafes, catering companies here in Ireland, including Joe's, Hatch & Sons, Alchemy Juice Company, and of course, Itza. Dominie, I'm exhausted reading all that out. You're very welcome to the programme this evening. Thanks a million for coming
in. Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
How are you getting on at the moment?
We won't mention it. Yeah, it's a very tough time for hospitality at the moment. So I guess we're just hoping that we get some sort of Christmas run. And, you know, I guess the restrictions on indoor dining coming into a kind of chilly winter, it's tricky. So look, we'll just wait and see. But I suppose there's some comfort in the fact that we're all in the same boat. And I guess, you know, it'd be great to get some run at Christmas and then just hope for a better 21.
I was in a well-known little spot in town there last week and I was thinking to myself, the cold will probably kill me. But, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, Dominie, isn't it? There's only bad clothes. Isn't that right?
That is exactly. It's funny. I was just talking to my daughter about that yesterday in terms of being in New York and years ago working in the States. And, you know, you just don't dress properly. But those cold American winters, you finally realize, oh, yes, that's what hats and scarves and thermal, you know. So you can endure really cold weather. But exactly that. It is dressing appropriate.
I think we have to spend lots of money on a really good winter coat this year if we want any kind of life
at all. And the thermals. Don't forget the thermals. Yeah. Very important.
Why did you become a chef?
I think because I'd failed at so many other things, possibly, I sort of fell into it. I had a career in horses, believe it or not, prior to that, and I was quite a strong junior rider, would have represented Ireland and so on, and then moved to senior level. And I guess really kind of my early 20s coming to the realization that not getting sponsorship, it's an expensive sport. You're always buying and selling horses. I had a tack shop, used to sell custom made stuff from the States, used to do some teaching, but it is hard to make a living. And I guess at that point, my sister had started her kind of culinary career and she started doing, some catering. And I used to go and work for her, kind of free slave labor, and really kind of just decided, you know what, I need a piece of paper. I'd been appalling at school, nearly failed my leaving, just decided I'll go to chef school. So I did that in the mid-90s over in London while I was still competing, and then really just got the bug and the horses kind of fell away, sold the last few, got stuck into the cooking, worked in some London restaurants, and then on a chance meeting came back to Dublin and met my former partner, and we spent 3 years. We had a Michelin star restaurant and a few different ones. So it was really a kind of plunge into the deep end at a very young age.
Once you get the taste for it, I suppose that was what brought you on the path and the passion.
Definitely. And I suppose, my former partner was Conor Gallagher, and he was a real sort of fantastic chef that exploded onto the scene here in Dublin in the 90s. You know, it was very sleepy up until that time and very much dominated by the sort of French fine dining type of influence. So Conor had come back from Monte Carlo and New York, and you know, he was this young, brash, full of confidence and full of charm, and was doing some really exciting food, in fairness. And really at that time, you know, Dublin was waking up and you had a lot of people coming back to the country and looking for something new and young and fresh. And, you know, we had a great team of people who all went through the stable doors at that point and really launched a new generation of restaurateurs and chefs and managers who went on to do bigger and better things.
When I lived in Cape Town, I was chatting to you earlier about Conrad. I remember I actually had him over for Christmas dinner once. We became friends down there and he said I cooked the best mashed potato that he'd ever had. So that was probably not true at all.
Yeah. Well, no, you see, it's all dependent on the butter to spud ratio. And if it's about 5 times butter to spuds, you can be guaranteed you like it.
Kerrygold was readily available at the time, so that's probably the secret of that, I suppose. What would you say, Dominie, would be sort of the most important ingredient that is, you know, made you successful today now?
I think certainly during my time that I spent with Conrad, you know, he was a master of seasoning and flavour. And I guess that was the one thing that really stuck with me. So for me, you know, taste is food. It doesn't matter whether it's very simple, whether it's a bowl of soup or a sandwich or a fine dining meal. It's that punch of flavour is really what you're just, it just that burst in your mouth. And I think that's the thing that always gets me. And I suppose it's why I'm so drawn to this industry, because, you know, you give that to somebody on their wedding day or something. It is such a, it's such a great feeling to give somebody that pleasure and just that sense of enjoyment and you know, community. It's sitting down and breaking bread together. There's nothing like it.
A lot of chefs talk about, you know, the journey that brings them there. And I suppose you're coupling the passion and your great skill for cooking with then, of course, running a business.
Totally.
And one kind of sometimes can overtake the other, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, my sister and I, we started our company in 1999, and it just started with one small bagel shop on the north side, you know, and it was just in the old Epicurean food hall, teeny tiny location. And, you know, the business grew from there and then, you know, extended into restaurants and cafes and catering. But, and I suppose it is something I love. I love the business aspect of it. I love working with people. I love bringing a concept to life, you know, from the original branding, the graphics, the story, the menu, the interiors. It's just such a great process and touches on so many different facets. So I think really lucky and, you know, to continually challenge yourself and develop and change and be able to tweak the business and remain relevant is all really important.
Going forward, the challenges, I mean, do you think it's going to be very difficult, or, you know, where do you see it going in the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, the frustrating part on the one hand is people, they say it takes about 2 months for habits to form, and people have definitely got really used to ordering in takeout. The environment was a big, big issue in the last couple of years in terms of sustainability and packaging and reduction and all those things. And then COVID came along, and a lot of that stuff all went out the window. You know, there's a complete shift and focus to convenience and safety. And that's a real pity. And I do get frustrated. You know, I have my restaurateur and business hat on, but I also have a big hat on when it comes to food and nutrition and health. And seeing people just not cooking is really frustrating. Now, I absolutely understand people's app, they're exhausted, they're stressed, they're working from home, they got kids and you know, picking up and tapping to get your dinner delivered. But it is a concern because, you know, arguably cooking for yourself is one of the best things you can do for your health. And if you completely outsource that, you're going to end up with problems.
I suppose every great chef or a person who has a passion for cooking has mentors as well. Have you got any mentors that were kind of helpful to you along the way in your process, in your journey?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think the whole idea of mentoring is something that's a lot more acceptable now than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago, where there was an element of nearly shame involved in saying, oh, I need some help here. So I think that's been really good for especially hospitality, because, you know, there are issues certainly around the stresses, the late nights, you know, trying to wind down quickly and people using alcohol or drugs to do that, and then the impact that has on your health. So I think mentoring and that kind of sense of community has been really improved in recent years. Certainly Ross Lewis is a mutual friend.
He's been a guest on our show here.
Yeah, and Ross is chapter one, obviously. Ross and Jess have always been really good supporters. Jess and I used to work together in Peacock Alley a million years ago. So Ross, I suppose, has been a good person always to bounce ideas off of, and has always kind of, he's a good person to give wise counsel. And then I suppose we have done some formal mentoring, my sister and I, because, again, when you have a partnership in a business, we're incredibly close. we spend a lot of time together, both in work and outside of work, but you do develop bad habits, and especially for the rest of the team in terms of direct lines of who people are reporting to and roles and responsibilities. And just to kind of remove some of those bad habits that had crept in from a good place, but they had crept in. And definitely, I think some of our senior team used to get frustrated with it. Well, who do I listen to here? You know, that kind of thing. So again, clear communication, taking back roles and responsibilities and being more answerable to each other at board level. That was something that we did and was really useful.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because Gareth Byrne, I was down in Campania there recently,
yes.
And he came out of Ross's stable,
another
I suppose.
Athlete, yeah.
And great things to say as well about Ross. Indeed, he learned a lot there. And it's great, actually. It is so important, I think, in your business. That seems to be a really good way to you know, bring chefs along.
Yeah.
And Ross was saying a lot about the mental, you know, mental well-being as well. That was so important. And, you know, the old days of chefs throwing cleavers around the kitchen and stuff is long gone.
It's such a cliche. It just doesn't happen anymore, you know, which is great and, you know, long overdue. But I think, you know, during lockdown, I did a lot of workshops with other business owners and cafes, and really, you know, we all tried to be as honest as we could during those times about how stressed and worried and concerned and scared we were in relation to our businesses. And, you know, I think having the confidence to admit that fear and that concern, it's very liberating. And also there's something, you know, the same way in therapy, shared problems and everything, very beneficial. And so I really encourage people to do that. If they haven't, find someone that they can talk to really honestly and unburden. Really important.
That brings us along, Dominique, to your first choice of music this evening, and a very popular artist, Stevie Wonder.
Put this on and you just feel like dancing. It just cheers you up. This song just makes me happy. It really does. It's an absolutely fantastic classic.
Wonderful. Stevie Wonder, Superstition.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
My guest this evening on A Taste of Ireland is Dominique Kemp. Back in 1998, you'd been treated for a malignant melanoma. But then in 2013, your world was turned upside down.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with breast cancer then. So my second bout of cancer. And I think it was interesting because I, you know, went full gamut in terms of chemo, mastectomy and then radiotherapy. So it's quite young at 42, I think it was. And I guess I really wanted to do as much as I could to try and support myself during what is really grueling treatment. And I guess I found that the information that was available at the time was quite limited and quite out of date. There was an excellent book I started reading by Dr. Servan Schreiber called Anti-Cancer. And it was a really simple book and a great starting point for people who are interested in nutrition and so on. He was a psychiatrist. He developed a brain tumor and he wrote a fabulous book basically on all the different diets around the world and things that people could do to help themselves. I found that there was a lot of resistance. I think there was we joke that the nutrition wars are like the religious wars, you know, of the 2000s. And I guess, you know, I think it's very important. Some people want to try and do as much as they can during treatment to support themselves through diet, exercise, lifestyle and so on. And other people don't. And I think, you know, it's entirely up to the individual, but it's about making informed choices. And I guess since 2013, I've really, really pushed this agenda, got myself into plenty of hot water as a result. But I think it's really important. And, you know, finally, we're starting to wake up to the idea of more integrated health and that it doesn't have to be either or. Why not have the best of conventional and the best of complementary and just combine them both into a really great integrated healthcare?
And I was reading, Domini, that you were actually born in the Bahamas.
That's right, yes.
With Celtic Irish skin, was that?
Worst combination. Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, you know, a 70s child, so very much no sunblock, no seatbelts. And that was the era that we lived in. Everyone smoked and drank too much. There just was a very different kind of approach. So definitely my dad was Scottish, my mother was Irish. And I'd say, you know, definitely we would have got bad burns as kids, as you do when you're out in the sun far too long and far too much. So definitely that would have contributed to getting the melanoma. But I suppose, you know, you have about, and in my 20s, you know, I know it sounds so stupid now, but even hearing the word malignant melanoma, I didn't think that was cancer. I was in my 20s, far too busy running the restaurant, did not have time for it, and didn't really want to know. And it was all done and dusted after a year of treatment. But really, in 2013, I was in my 40s. I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Today now, the thing about cancer is when you're cleared, is it always a worry for you? I suppose, is that why, in a way, you've become so vociferous and so strong on, of course, diet and, you know, food is medicine, really, sort of thing?
Definitely. And again, you'll get, you know, even that idea of food is medicine is is one that's very divisive. And you will get some medics saying, absolutely not, medicine is medicine. But again, I just don't think it has to be this either or. And, you know, there's a new band of oncologists who are incredibly interested in nutrition, Professor Rob Thomas over in the UK. And he's really interesting in terms of he's very anti-sugar, he's very anti-processed foods, and is very much a fan of sleep and exercise and stuff. So he's a great one to listen to because he is a conventional oncologist, but he just happens to place a huge value on your environment and what you can do as a patient. So he's great to listen to. And in the US, they're hugely into it, and certainly in places like Germany. So we have a lot of catching up to do. And really, you know, oncologists have this amazing opportunity, I think. And there are certainly several over in this country, but you have this amazing opportunity where you have a patient sitting opposite you, basically saying, what do I do? Tell me what to do. And my frustration was being handed a copy of the food pyramid is just not acceptable. Mm. You know, we need to do better, and nutrition needs to be more personalized. It's really a vital issue that I think needs constant addressing and pushing.
And how did those changes impact your life? Is it just something you get used to?
Yeah, I think, I definitely am constantly conflicted because I'm a chef and I love all food and I love eating. And then after, you know, getting the diagnosis, and I met my co-author Patricia Daly, who's a nutritional therapist. She'd gone through cancer herself as well. And we decided to write a book that we both wished we'd had access to during our own cancer treatment and our own kind of cancer discovery. So we wrote The Ketogenic Kitchen, and it's about two different approaches. Mine very much focused on low carb eating. So really kind of plant rich, nutrient dense diet that is really reducing your sort of processed carbohydrates, your beige carbohydrates. Then if you wanted to go further, you could then, you know, go for a ketogenic diet, provided, you know, you are given the okay by your doctor, because it is metabolic therapy. It is quite restrictive, and it can be a challenge, and it's not suitable for everyone. So we wrote this book, but, you know, of course, we started off bringing bagels into the country. So my life revolves around a lot of beige food.
And very good,
so
they are too.
So delicious.
I love the tuna melt, by the way. Go on.
I love it. It's like it's a torture. So, but for me, I discovered that actually eating in a low carb manner was much better for me. And certainly as a cancer patient was something that I certainly, looking at the research and understanding what carbohydrate restriction means and the impact in terms of keeping steadier blood glucose levels, and then not having, say, the corresponding insulin spikes. And I guess where the research is going is, you know, insulin can be a problem for cancer patients. So really trying to just keep things a little cooler, less inflammatory. That's all really the aim of how I eat now.
What would you say to people like that have, you know, come through cancer and now, you know, are, I suppose, trying to put a plan in place, yeah, like you were touching on there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the criticism is that people turn to the internet and, you know, they consult Dr. Google and they can go off on very extreme diets. And look, the reality is there's no diet that can cure cancer or, you know, entirely prevent it or so on. But there certainly is very good, arguments and certainly plenty of evidence to suggest that cutting down on sugar and processed foods is a very good start. Trying to eat as nutrient dense a diet that is plant rich, for want of a better word, is also really beneficial. People will argue about everything from dairy to meat to everything in between. And really, I suppose, you know, protein and fats are absolutely essential for our diet. Carbohydrate, not, you know, they're the only macronutrient that is not essential for us. And really, I suppose, but it's very difficult to eat a zero carbohydrate diet unless you eat 100% carnivore diet. And really, that's very restrictive and not that pleasant. So you're always going to eat carbohydrates. It's really about, you know, I guess the idea that people get up in the morning and have cereal and toast and orange juice and then maybe have a sandwich for lunch and then pasta for dinner. That is really a diet that's very full of processed, you know, carbohydrates. And I guess you're not getting enough plants into you. So, you know, as I said, everyone fights about what's the perfect diet, but it's entirely about the individual.
Yeah. I mean, do you have any advice for people that would love to make that shift, you know, that mind shift? Because I find personally sometimes that when, you know, what if I'm stressed or, you know, I'll go for a bacon sandwich or a sausage sandwich if I've been traveling when I was able to travel, Dominic, you know, now it's just the far reaches of Dublin. But, yeah. You know, it's that kind of comforting. Have you any advice for people that would love to just try this, break that cycle of the carbohydrate thing? It's almost addictive, really.
I think if people are looking to make a start, it is about identifying, I guess, those weak spots. And the problem with carbohydrates is you do get these spikes, you know, in terms of blood glucose comes up, then it comes crashing down. And that's why you get the kind of hangry sensation. Certainly replacing those foods and, you know, people would say maybe instead of spuds, you'd look at things like chickpeas or lentils, things that would be more slow releasing. And then, you know, if that's working for you and you feel good, you might want to pack it in even more vegetables. But it's baby steps, you know, and that's the thing. And looking at your diet and, you know, keeping a food diary is really illustrative in the sense that we all pretend, you know, we all lie about what we eat. Everyone does, which is why nutrition studies are so poor, because they're always relying on recall. And of course, no one can remember. And then even if they do remember it, they're going to lie about it, you know. So it's a really poor way to conduct nutrition studies. But actually, if you write an honest food diary, it is interesting to see and just seeing what you could replace with more whole foods. And as I said, you know, of course, bacon sandwich, sausage sandwich, so delicious. Yeah, why wouldn't you want
keeping
one?
A food diary, that's the mortification diet. Is it like, I'd look back, oh my God, did I eat all that?
It is hard. But, you know, it's also like, you know, somebody opening a pack of crisps and a glass of wine. You know, they go so well together. Nuts, roasted, delicious, you know, and the salty sweets and snacks, fabulous, you know. But again, it's sort of it's really being honest with what you're eating and then seeing what you can kind of replace.
Yeah, and I suppose switching from peanuts to maybe salted almonds or something.
Maybe exactly, yeah. And then
a little
you
bit.
Might say, go with some veg and maybe a nice dip. I mean, the thing is that when you are eating a more low-carb diet, you do tend to introduce a bit more fat. And the thing is, we've been so conditioned. We've had 40 years of low-fat propaganda that it's very difficult for people to say, actually, full fat is better. And naturally, there's a sense of satiety in the sense that you're fuller when you eat the fat. You have to look at low-fat products. They remove the fat and then they fortify it with a bunch of vitamins and stuff because they've removed everything in the first place. It's usually higher in sugar as a result of the removal of the fat. And it's terribly processed. You're better off looking at the kind of whole food, original, less processed forms. So, you know, whole fat yogurt, whole milk and so on. These are all good natural foods. when you look at the zero fat yogurt, they're full of rubbish, full of rubbish, and they're not very satisfying. So, you know, again, it's understanding that you reduce your carbs, okay, to increase your fat a little bit and go from there.
Is there any one food or one, I know I'm putting you on the spot now, or one superfood, or if somebody was to say, you know, especially we were talking there about cancer earlier and people that boosting immune system, is there any one thing that you think really packs a punch in terms of, you know, bang for your buck?
Yeah, and I think, you know, everyone, you get a lot of medics and healthcare professionals getting really angry at the word superfoods to say, no such food as superfood. It's like, well, actually, there are plenty of foods that are super. They really pack a nutritional punch, you know. And if
sausage sandwiches are super. Like, I love those.
They are super in a different kind of way.
Not great for the old waistline, though, Dominic.
But it's especially a load of ketchup on it and loads of butter. Delicious. Yeah. But I mean, I think certainly herbs and spices are very overlooked in terms of what they can do. And, you know, things like garlic and ginger and turmeric. I mean, turmeric's amazing. And when you combine it with some fat and some black pepper, you really increase the efficacy of it in terms of, you know, anti-inflammatory. So things like that are just fabulous to take. And like green herbs, again, great bang for buck. Obviously, things like kale, oily fish, eggs, these are all great foods. And again, they're sorely missing from a lot of our diets. So, you know, again, it's looking, you can look up all sorts of references to sort of the most super, the most nutritious foods. And you'll often see things like your avocado, spinach, kale, your oily fish, nuts and seeds, eggs, all being kind of super along with herbs and spices.
Wonderful. I'm writing all this down. Now, listen, that brings us along very nicely to your next song, your next music choice this evening, which, of course, a famous man, David Bowie.
I know. And just such an incredible artist. I mean, what a, just a catalogue of amazing music that he left behind. So, yeah, huge fan of his. So, yeah, Life on Mars. Listen to this man forever.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with.
A Taste of Ireland with Discover Northern Ireland. Your next giant adventure is just a small step away. DiscoverNorthernIreland.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
You're listening to A Taste of Ireland, and my special guest this evening is Dominic Kemp. Dominic, you've written 5 books. Very impressive. The book, The Ketogenic Kitchen, it's an absolutely wonderful book. Low carb, high fat, extraordinary health. I cooked the chicken with lemon and green olives because I knew you were coming in and I wanted to, I've done a few of them.
You didn't bring me any.
And now I did embellish it with the yellow pepper, right, myself. But I must say, and a little bit of chili as well because I love spicy food. But this is really fascinating. For anybody who doesn't know the ketogenic kitchen or the ketogenic diet, I mean, it's huge in the US. It's not so big here. It really has swept the boards there. I mean, it's resulted in people losing swathes and vast amounts of excess weight. It has been, you know, it has been really endemic in terms of people's energy levels.
Yes.
It's just done so much stuff. And I think for a lot of people, and me included, getting your head around the fact that we've been brainwashed about the low fat idea and the fact that you can have butter and coconut oil and all these kind of, which would be kind of a, you know, fatty think, oh my God, how could I lose weight doing, eating all that stuff? So could you tell people really in a nutshell, I suppose, what is the ketogenic diet?
Yeah. So I think it goes back to your point, you know, people think fat equals fat and, you know, it's not as simple as that. But the ketogenic diet actually was originally established for epilepsy. And I guess then really it started to be looked at in terms of things like weight loss and type 2 diabetes, because again, what it does is it throws your body from burning carbohydrates, which is the normal fuel, as it were, that the body uses, into burning fat. So you are restricting the amount of carbohydrates. Your body switches, so almost from a diesel engine to a petrol engine, your body switches and starts burning fat.
Now, one of the common mistakes with the ketogenic diet or thoughts around it, and again, I have to really preface, it's not suitable for everyone. There are definitely some, people have impaired liver function, etc. It's not a diet for them. So it is quite powerful metabolic therapy, and they, you know, people should get the go ahead before they start it. But one of the, I suppose, misconceptions is that, you're eating steak for breakfast, you know, a bit like the Atkins, that you're eating unlimited amounts of fat and so on. That's not the way forward. So even though you have a classic one for epilepsy, when you're looking at it for weight loss or type 2 diabetes, for which it's really well established now in terms of its safety record and success, there are some fruits, there's plenty of green vegetables. You know, again, it's about having a really nutrient dense ketogenic diet or low carb diet if you want something a little bit more moderate. And that's what's really important. The idea also that you can have unlimited amounts of fat is a misconception. You know, even though you're increasing your fat, if you're putting butter into your coffee and everything, you're going to have problems.
That was one thing that I found that was big in America. There's a whole coffee, cafes have come up, built up around this. Yeah, the bulletproof. Yeah. That seems to be, I mean, quite strange for us to think that you put a spoon of butter into your coffee.
Yeah, and it's a bit revolting, if I'm honest, and the thing is, it's interesting. A study just came out, and again, it's part of the nutrition wars, and it was looking at intermittent fasting, you know, which is something I really enjoy doing. I love fasting. The last couple of years, I've done a 10-day fast. Fast and so on. It's really great as a kind of reset for health. But, intermittent fasting, I really like doing, and sort of just eat one meal in the evening time. I might have a little cream in my coffee in the morning and that's it. And it'll keep me going. A lot of herbal teas and maybe the little bit of a broth later on at lunchtime. But really the idea is that your body does, you know, it's this metabolic flexibility, which is kind of what you're after. But a study came out and it was looking at intermittent fasting, and it was sort of saying, oh, well, actually, people who were fasting didn't lose more weight than the other group that were able to eat kind of what they wanted. But it's missing the point. When you're intermittent fasting, you're usually missing one or two meals. And I guess, again, it's a study that comes out, people snatch the headlines, and, you know, it's like those things, coffee causes cancer, and then 2 weeks later, coffee cures, you know, it's like...
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time as well, I've tried... I like that intermittent fasting because I feel it's, the way our bodies are like engines and we're constantly eating. And if you're constantly stoking up the engine, I just personally feel it's wear and tear, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's interesting. Again, you have to look at where some of these messages come from in terms of these sort of doctrines, as it were. And, you know, you can sometimes trace them back to food companies that sell breakfast bars and cereals. Suits them to be telling you to eat little and often and to constantly snack and graze. Well, why do we need to constantly snack and graze? You know, our ancestors didn't do it. And certainly we live in a food environment that is, you know, people say obesogenic, that is, it's far too plentiful. We can access food 24 hours a day if we want. And really not giving your system a break is, you know, you can understand how you never give your system a chance to reset. So this idea of sort of cells being able to replenish and to die off and to do that bit of housekeeping, you know, having good periods where you're not always stuffing your face with snacks, that's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've never seen a fat lion or a gazelle either. I suppose nature does it really well, doesn't it?
Really well. And again,
and the processed foods, of course.
That's exactly it. And I think that, you know, when you look at it, it's a really good study, and it showed even women who were able to sort of fast for a 13-hour period, breast cancer patients, they had, again, better outcomes. And you kind of think, oh, 13 hours. But actually, that's maybe eating at 6 or 7 p.m. and not eating again maybe until 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. Very doable, very doable. And when you look at the significant risks and the benefits achieved, again, this is a simple thing that someone could do to improve their overall health.
The dish I cooked there, the chicken with lemon and green olives, was delicious. I mean, a lot of people might think that some of the stuff, you know, doesn't taste good. I mean, the flavour was amazing. I did the turmeric and I did a lot of the stuff, which
is gorgeous.
Really, really healthy. And it's really filling. And of course, touching on Mediterranean as well with olives and the herbs, as you said, for anyone, Dominie, that would like to start off doing it, I mean, what advice be to them?
Yeah, so I say definitely start off the first half of the book, and like, or start any book that's a sort of low carb book, because again, it's just giving you different ideas of what to eat for breakfast and lunch when your go-to might be some toast or something like that. So really, that's the idea, sort of a breakfast that might be a bit more kind of fruit driven or even vegetable driven. Eggs as well, you know, they had such a bad rap for years. Eggs are brilliant food to have, you know, a frittata in the morning or some scrambled eggs with a handful of spinach and some tomatoes. Amazing breakfast, you know, a really good vegetable soup for lunch. And then dinner might be more vegetables and a little bit of good quality protein and again, healthy fats. So that's the kind of thing that you eat. Certainly for low carb, I do have, you know, some pulses, some legumes and so on. Many because I really like them and there are some health benefits. I'm not fully keto. I'd find it too difficult, but certainly low carb really, really works. And again, it's knowing those danger spots. So most people, evening time, stomach's hungry, you know, tired and thingy. There's some really great recipes for like low carb crackers and breads. Things that you want to put fat on, so maybe a little bit of cheese or butter with them, but they just stop you from reaching for those crisps or something else that's quick and fast and is going to, you know, solve that salty hunger that you often can have in the evening time.
That is the thing. You're absolutely right on that. And how long does it take, or how long did it take you to break that carb cycle or that, you know, addiction?
Yeah, it was certainly a while. And it just, it's really understanding what happens to you when you eat carbs and sort of the impact that it does. You know, I am a bit of a nerd, so I'd put a continuous glucose monitor on to really track what was going on. And again, it's so interesting to see what different foods and even a bad night's sleep, what that can do to your glucose level. It's also, you know, people going through keto, like if they do transfer to a ketogenic diet, you know, they can feel grim for a couple of days. They can go through what's known as the keto flu. But again, you know, it's not for everyone. And that's the thing. You often hear people plunging straight into something and it doesn't suit them and they make loads of mistakes and it all goes kind of haywire. It is something you have to kind of invest some time and education and get the all clear from a doctor before you start it. But certainly low carb is a very safe and healthy way to eat. And certainly doing that is a great place to start and see how you feel. You know, some people feel brilliant on a vegan diet. Some people feel brilliant on the, it is absolutely all dependent on the individual.
What recipe would you give people for uplifting your mental health and making you feel a little bit, a natural high, Dominie? about that? A natural high. And I'm not talking about the Chianti, you know.
No, the grapes. I'll put grapes in there somewhere. I think actually, breakfast tends to be a real struggle. And actually, there are two recipes in Patricia's section of the book, which I really love. One is there's a keto granola bar, which is just brilliant because you can have it in the freezer, which is really good in terms of it lasts forever. But it's just, I find if I'm on the go, I can usually be intermittent fasting and I can think, if I'm sitting at home, I'm usually writing about foods. I'm either writing up menus or something. And I find it very hard if I'm sitting at home all day not to think, wonder what I could eat downstairs.
Like Nigella sneaking down for the chocolate cake in the middle of the night.
Much less glamorous, but yeah, something like that. So these are actually a great one because a tiny little lump of them is a brilliant thing to have with a cup of tea. But there's also a keto smoothie in there with coconut milk and loads of berries. And again, it's a really great thing. And kids really love it as well. I'll tell you, they're stuffed going to school on it. It's got some protein in it and everything. A really great way to start the day.
Well, Dominie, that brings us along to your final choice of music this evening. And this is something I love to do, by the way, daydreaming Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, she's just so incredible. And again, beautiful album, Young, Gifted and Black. This is just one of the tracks on it. And it's just stunning. She just, oh, again, I could listen to her forever.
Dominie Kemp, it has been a great pleasure talking to you this evening.
Thank you.